ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Later this year, all Australians over 18 will get to vote on whether or not they support a voice to Parliament. It's been 20 years since our last referendum, so the Australian Electoral Commission is now upping the ante to get as many Australians to enrol to vote as possible. Key to this is translating messaging about the referendum into Indigenous language, much like during the pandemic when Indigenous elders translated health information to encourage people to get vaccinated. Because in Australia, 97% of the eligible population have enrolled to vote, but among Indigenous Australians, that number dropped significantly to 84.5%. On Australia-wide, why towns in regional WA are staging mock referendums to improve lagging Indigenous enrolment rates. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia-wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth.
Hello, this is Kathleen. I'm extremely humbled and extremely grateful for being pardoned and released from prison. My eternal gratitude goes to my friends and family, especially Tracy and all of her family, and I would not have survived this whole ordeal without them. Today is a victory for science and especially truth. And for the last 20 years I have been in prison, I have forever and will always think of my children, grieve for my children, and have missed them and love them terribly. Thank you.
Kathleen Fulbig speaking for the first time in a recorded video today after being released from prison yesterday. The now 55-year-old spent 20 years in jail for killing her four children. Yesterday, she was pardoned and had her first night of freedom. And she spent that night with her friend and supporter, Tracy Chapman, at a rural property in Coffs Harbour in New South Wales. Tracy Chapman told a big media contingent how good it was to enjoy the simple things in life with her friend after such a long time.
Yesterday was such a rush. Mr. Daly didn't really appreciate that yesterday. I was so unprepared. We had, it was one of those surreal days where you just kind of threw all your plans out the window. Kath and I were grateful though, and we just got on with having a, it was just surreal. Actually, I can't actually say anything more than it was a surreal day. We just kind of got, enjoyed each other's company. She spent a lot of time with my dogs and getting to know my animals, and we didn't get our steak for dinner, which was a bugger. So so we've had pizza last night. We've had a bit of a flashback to 20 years. She asked for a Kahlua and Coke, so she had her first alcoholic beverage was a flashback for the last 20 years of a Kahlua and Coke. Garlic bread and pizza for dinner. I feel pretty ashamed of that, but, you know, that's what you get. She slept for the first time in a real bed. She's made a cup of tea with real, in a real crockery cup and had real spoons to stir with, which sounds probably pretty basic to you all, but that's, she's grateful. Decent tea, you know, real milk, and slept in a real bed last night. So she's actually, she said it was the first time she's been able to sleep properly in 20 years, even though it was brief last night because we were all on adrenaline. She was able to turn over in her bed and not wake herself up.
An emotional Tracy Chapman, who's a friend and supporter of Kathleen Fulbig, talking about her first night of freedom. And she certainly was really excited. Our reporter, Nick Parmeter, is in Coffs Harbour, and he was at the press conference with Kathleen's lawyers and supporters. Nick, a huge national media contingent in town. What was the mood like at that conference?
I describe the mood of the press conference as jubilant. Tracy Chapman was very, very buoyant. She was happily chatting away with members of the media before and after the press conference proper, and she was just giving us little bits and pieces of what they got up to last night. Among those were having her first alcoholic beverages in 20 years or more, and also marvelling at the wonders of modern technology, that being streaming services like Netflix. And it's safe to say that there's a plenty that she's being caught up on by those friends, Sinead.
It really, you do get that feeling of excitement from Tracy Chapman, and it's just hard to fathom what they've all been through. Nick, the media conference happened in town and then you went out to the rural property where Kathleen is staying. Is there many media out there?
There is absolutely, Sinead. Just about every media outlet is out there, and Tracy Chapman did actually return to the property, I'd say maybe just in the early afternoon, maybe about 1:30 East Coast time. Yes, the media scrum was in full effect. Tracy was her bubbly self, and actually we saw a couple of strangers, they were not known to Miss Folbig or Tracy Chapman, give some flowers to Tracy Chapman as she entered the home. And they also had a hug and they had a nice little chat as well. But yeah, it's a bit of a stakeout mode, I suppose, for want of a better term at the moment, Sinead, at that property in Glenray.
Sometimes these things can become a bit of a three-ring circus. Is it calm, or what's the kind of mood of it?
Yeah, I certainly empathise with that. It's probably not quite entered circus territory yet, but there is obviously such strong media and public interest in this story, and that's certainly being reflected by the amount of media that are there and waiting, I suppose, for a glimpse of Kathleen Folbig. Look, we did hear a few people driving past, and they shouted out things like "Leave her alone," and I did see a few people sort of shaking their heads as they walked past, and yeah, that's certainly understandable. More than 20 years in prison for Miss Folbig, and I think the focus at the moment is on just enjoying those first few days of freedom. And her legal team have asked that her privacy be respected, particularly at this early stage of her release.
What about the response from town? You said Glenray, is that right? Am I saying that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Glenray, it's a small place, only about 1,000 people living there, and then you get this kind of circus of media pull into town. Is everyone staying in town? Like, what's the town's kind of response to this thing evolving right around them, which they would never have expected or anticipated?
It's a country town and the people are pretty salt of the earth. A couple of them made a couple of jokes about, the media presence there, but it all felt pretty lighthearted. It didn't feel as if, we were unwelcome. It's probably quite a daunting or maybe even intimidating presence for some people. And you can certainly understand those few people who did, have something to say as they drove past that rural property there too.
Nick, what did you find out about Kathleen's plans? She wants to have a few days to herself with her mates. Beyond that, is there any other information?
I think it's really difficult to say at this point, Sinead. Tracy Chapman and the legal team sort of said that, yeah, right now it's about enjoying the little things. There's plans, I believe, tonight maybe to have a bit of a barbie. Fresh vegetables were mentioned. I don't think that's something that you get in prison, fresh veggies, and a nice steak. They missed out on a steak last night. I don't think that'll happen again. Looking beyond that, of course, the journey is not over yet as far as a complete clearing of the name. The charges are yet to be quashed, and the question of compensation is certainly one that the legal team has in the back of mind at the moment. But Sinead, at this point in time, I think the focus for Kathleen Folbig and her closest confidants and supporters is to enjoy those first few days of freedom in 20 years.
Fair enough. To Nick Parmeter in Coffs Harbour, thanks for chatting to Australia Wide.
My pleasure.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
It's been more than two decades since a referendum was held in Australia, so for many people, this year's vote on an Indigenous voice to Parliament will be an unfamiliar experience. The Australian Electoral Commission has partnered with groups in WA's Goldfields and Pilbara to run a series of mock referendums to help prepare communities, and the model may be rolled out nationally. Reporter Terry Campbell went along to one at Norseman, 2 hours south of Kalgoorlie, to see how the process works.
Naju Ranger Darius Evans-Wicker usually spends his days caring for country and sacred sites across the vast Norseman region. But today, he's walking along the wide streets of the town centre towards a pop-up polling booth.
I've come along just to get a better understanding of what a referendum is, because I have absolutely no idea what it is.
The 23-year-old is at a mock referendum run by the Australian Electoral Commission and the Goldfields Aboriginal Language Centre.
I'm just going to shake these ballots all out.
It aims to prepare residents in remote WA communities to vote on the proposed Indigenous voice to Parliament later this year. Danielle Savage is the Electoral Commission's Acting State Manager for WA.
So we're out here in Norseman today doing voter education sessions, doing a practice referendum. So it's really exciting times to be out here.
Across Australia, 97% of the eligible population is enrolled to vote. But among Indigenous Australians, that number drops to 85%. In Western Australia, the Indigenous enrolment rate is the lowest in the country at 74%. Danielle Savage hopes these mock referendums will help change that.
So we acknowledge that our rates are a little bit lower, but we're so vast, and that's the challenge for us out here. But that's why we're out and about, so that we can make sure that we get those enrolment numbers up.
Locals came up with the mock referendum question, whether Norseman the horse, the town's namesake, is more famous than the tin camels on its roundabout. Sue Hansen, the CEO of the Goldfields Aboriginal Language Centre, says they hope it's a topic everyone understands.
Of course, the referendum question's written in standard Australian English, and the sentence structure and the ways that the question are asked are different to how they would be phrased in Aboriginal languages. Miscommunication or a lack of communication is a very big issue. So we're helping to translate the referendum question at the moment into a number of languages.
After moving from the Philippines more than 5 years ago, Anne O'Conn hopes she will get to vote in the Voice to Parliament referendum.
Basically, I will have my citizenship ceremony soon, so I guess, like the guy was saying, by the time the referendum comes, I might be able to vote. So it's definitely a good thing for me to come and learn how to do it.
The last referendum in Australia was 24 years ago, so the process is new to lots of people.
We have been out and about prior to elections in previous years, but we know that this has been such an experience and people just don't know the difference. So we really want to make sure that we educate them so they can vote in this upcoming referendum this year. Our social media is very active, people asking what is a referendum, how to do it, what should we do. So we thought, oh, we better get out there and educate people.
Open this ballot here first.
By midday, the final count is in.
For the motion that is Norseman the horse more famous than the tin camel roundabout, the motion is yes. So that passes as a referendum if it was one. So congratulations to Norman the horse.
Darius Evans-Wicker is pleased his vote matched the winning side.
Because I'm also a logical thinker, because a lot of tourists do come by and see the camels.
But importantly, he's now enrolled and feeling more at ease going into his first referendum on The Voice.
It was a lot more simpler than what I imagined it would be.
The AEC's next stop is Warburton, south of the Gibson Desert, and it's hoping to run other mock referendums around the country later in the year.
This week we've been in Leonora and Coolgardie and obviously Norseman, which is where we are today. We're looking to go to Marble Bar, Warburton, and we're also hoping to pop down at Esperance as well. So we've got a few more planned, and I should imagine as hopefully the message grows, we might get a request for a couple more.
We're getting a bit of momentum there. Danielle Savage from the Australian Electoral Commission, ending that story from Terry Campbell. And you can read more about that on the ABC News website. The Leyland brothers were an Australian travel documentary sensation through the 70s, 80s and 90s, with TV shows, films and even an ill-fated theme park in northern New South Wales. Thousands of Australians were inspired to go bush after watching the outback adventures and exploits of a couple of daring siblings. Our reporter, Chris Calcino, has tracked down the last surviving Leyland brother, who now calls Toowoomba home.
Whatever it is that you want to see, ask the Leylands, no matter whatever that happens to be, ask the Leyland brother.
If you went anywhere near an Australian TV from the 1960s through to the 90s, chances are this next voice will sound familiar.
G'day, I'm Mal Leyland, and a lot of people listening to this, at least I hope a lot of people listening to this, will remember the name. And my brother Mike and myself started making travel films and going all places that we wanted to, and made documentary films about it for 55 years.
Mike and Mal Leyland grew up watching the exploits of wildlife documentary filmmakers Armand and Michaela Dennis, all filmed on 16mm cameras. But in 1956, Mike entered a comic strip he had drawn to a radio competition with tickets to the Melbourne Olympics as the top prize.
And he won the trip. And Dad had to cough up for the camera that he promised he'd buy him if he did. But the very first film he ever shot was us going on a daily picnic with the family. And then the next film he shot was at the Olympic Games.
Mike had caught the bug, and it wasn't long before his younger brother followed suit. Mike's first real job, other than a previous gig as a sign writer, was as a news cameraman, and Mal landed work as a photographer with the Newcastle Sun. But they'd already notched up some exciting outback journeys, and their future was in the great outdoors.
The very first actual trip we did was to go to Central Australia in a Land Rover. Very nearly did a perish, though, because we decided to cross 100 miles of desert without a road in front of us, just using a compass. And managed to get out the other side and arrived at Kerber Pedy in the opal fields, much to the amazement of a few people, because when we arrived, we had virtually not a sniff of petrol left in the tank.
Alf believes the camel is one of the best means of travel in the world and needs no encouragement to knock off carving to mount up and spend a few days on walkabout, observing the world from his elevated perch on the camel.
The Leyland brothers were a sensation. They had movies, TV shows and a huge following all over Australia and even in places like Japan. At a certain point, they decided to open their own Leyland Brothers World theme park on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. It was a financial disaster.
So what we did was build something that was a 1/32nd scale model of Ayers Rock. We ended up hiring a huge crane. I did a lot of the welding myself, especially up high, because we couldn't get anyone to work up there. It was great times and we were doing very well. But in order to do it, we had to borrow money. And we got $3 million loan. Blew out to 3.3 by the time we opened the door, because the interest rates went right through the roof. They went from 12%, which we thought was pretty rich, to 28%. Within 14 months, and that is a lot of money.
Leyland Brothers World was shut down, and many years later that huge replica of Uluru would catch fire and be reduced to ash and rubble. Something similar happened to the Leyland Brothers relationship. Both Mal and Mike went bankrupt after the failed theme park venture, and personal tensions that had been simmering away for years finally reached breaking point.
Brother and I were very much alike in so many ways, and we'd been through so much together. What was there as a bond was still impossible to break, but by golly, the only reason it didn't actually snap was because we worked hard at making sure we didn't want that to happen. But in the end, it was the interest rates that put the pressure on us and caused it all to happen. We'd missed a payment and the bank moved on us, basically chucked us out. And was left then with nothing.
Mike Leyland died from Parkinson's disease in 2009 at the age of 68. By that stage, the brothers had made amends, but his brother's death affected Mal greatly.
It was never like it was. When he finally passed away, I was pretty bad. Lorraine knew. She'd taken the phone call and then I had to take it over. And to be perfectly honest, I couldn't really believe that he'd gone. But it's a bit like any close family member, like Lorraine's gone too, and that was the same. In fact, it was worse. That is life. Death is actually at the end of it for all of us. We have to face that reality, I guess.
It's been almost 14 years since Mike's death, and more than 60 years since this pair first started filming their adventures around Australia. But Mal's not done travelling yet, and he might still have one last show up his sleeve.
Oh no, I don't go anywhere without the camera, and I'm still doing that. This trip I'm about to do, I'm going to film it. Exactly how I'm going to use it at the end, I'm not sure. I would like to think that it reached a big audience, and I think one of the ways of doing that would be to offer it to one of the TV networks. I've got good relationships with all of them, including the ABC. But I'd like it to be perhaps my last hurrah. I don't know. But the places are still good, and the people that live out there are great people. Always have been and always will be, in my opinion.
Travel all over the countryside, Australians, Australians. Travel all over the countryside, Australian brothers.
That song really gets into your head. That was Mal Leyland of the Leyland Brothers speaking with our reporter, Chris Calzino.
ABC Australia Wide.
And finally, we're going to meet a bit of a character. He's an OAM for services to aviation and medicine, and now in his 80s, much-loved local doctor David Cook is still flying to treat regional patients on the New South Wales mid-north coast. In his spare time, he takes up a vintage plane to lead a weekly aerial formation display over Port Macquarie. He told reporter Emma Seosian he's no plans to put down the landing gear on his career anytime soon.
It's a clear Saturday morning, and David Cook is preparing to take to the skies in his vintage de Havilland Chipmunk aircraft.
The aeroplane is 1950 vintage, so it's 73 years old. Not as old as me, though.
At 81, David has been both a pilot and a doctor for more than 50 years, including time with the Royal Flying Doctor Service. Each weekend, he leads an aerial display over the Port Macquarie region as part of a small group of experienced pilots. They call themselves the Bobcats, and their formations require intense concentration.
When you are following a leading aeroplane, you're not looking at your instruments or the ground or anything. You're just looking at the more or less the back of his head, and you're positioning yourself. It's a sort of real workout for us all. But we all love it. The pilots are, as I said, one's a retired fighter pilot, the other one is a retired jumbo captain. Now, the guy that was there this morning is an eye specialist in town.
He says flying is a passion that's been passed through generations.
My grandfather flew in 1915 in the First World War, and then my father was a Spitfire pilot, and he went to England and was killed a month before I was born in 1941 in Yorkshire, and we often go and visit his little grave. My mother then married another bomber captain in 1945, and he was killed just before the end of the war. And then after the war, my mother married a flying boat captain who survived and brought me up. And so I've been flying since 1958 in the Air Force Reserve while I was doing first year medicine.
With medical services scarce in some parts of the region, Dr. Cook's work plane is a handy means of transport to the nearby town of Southwest Rocks.
All the small country towns are very short of doctors. Port Macquarie's the same. So I just come up here two mornings a week to add to the medical manpower of the town.
He then hops on his motor scooter and heads back to the modified cow paddock he uses as a runway to return to Port Macquarie.
It's only 11 minutes to get to Southwest Rocks by air, so I'm up there in no time. The owner chases the cows off the airstrip before I come, or make sure they're not on the strip, and I land there and I have a little motor scooter which I putt into town on. People ask me if I'm going to retire at 81, and I say, oh, look, I actually love work. I was a flying doctor for years in the outback, and so old habits die hard. When I was a flying doctor, my boss used to say, you're not a doctor that flies, you're a pilot that practices medicine. So it's just being up there and a medium in which you can move in all directions. I come from a long line of pilots. I'm the black sheep being a doctor, actually, because both my sons are jet captains, and my father and my grandfather are pilots. So
It's a bit of a disease with the family.
I've got six granddaughters and soon to be a grandson, and one of them hopefully will be the next generation of pilots. If you talk to any pilot, they get a faraway look in their eyes and just say, we just like being up there.
What a character. That is David Cook, and he was speaking there to our reporter, Emma Seosian. And that's Australia-wide for this Tuesday. I hope you're having a lovely evening. I'm Sinead Mangan. I'll speak to you again tomorrow. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.